The Breakfast Club.
Whitey, good morning.
I appreciate being here.
It's nice to have you with us.
Good morning. And the great news over the last few days has been the fact that there will be crowds for all 4 days.
Yes.
And everything opens up again further from Friday at 6 o'clock. So Flemington have got their timing right.
Perfect timing.
Just like they've waited to the clock tower before they've really accelerated to the line.
Well, you can't go earlier than the clock tower. You just can't. You know the rules at Flemington.
No.
So that's a given. But that's exciting news for headquarters, exciting news for the carnival too. And, well, bigger picture, for Victorians as we start to just slowly creep out of the fog that we've been covered in for the last however long.
Did you get out of the fog over the weekend at all?
I did.
You do that was not what you haven't been able to do for 80-odd days?
Well, I'll tell you about that as soon as we welcome our third wheel here on a Monday morning on The Breakfast Club.
From a hospital ward?
Well, my understanding was he was 3 foot down. He was in the coffin. He was caught in the box, 3 foot down, and then he put his hand up and said, wait, I'm back. I'm alive. I'm good. I need to bounce back and be on the program with the boys on a Monday morning. Adam Ramanauskas, fresh from 3 feet down in the grave, has rejoined us as one of the greats of all time at the Essendon Football Club these days, manager to the Stars. Rama, good morning.
Well, good morning. Yeah, they simply couldn't dig the hole deep enough just to get me down there, quick enough. So, but yeah, look, it's fair to say it's been a couple of interesting days since Wednesday. So, had a little bit of back surgery and been flat on the back. But I thought, you know, time to get up and get moving again.
I was thinking,
as Rama, the little moving I'm allowed to do, actually.
I was thinking when you said you were going to be joining us on this beautiful Monday morning that you would be lying down, perhaps on your side maybe, just sort of propping yourself up with a couple of pillows on the back of the back surgery. But you're seemingly sitting up. You're up and about.
Well, I'm standing up. I'm allowed to lie flat or stand. So I've decided to take the standing sort of method for the first hour, and then we'll see how we progress from there. But no, I'm okay. It was a decent old surgery, but we push on. We push on, as Whitey would always say, just get on with things.
Was it more extensive than you thought it was going to be in the end, or?
Well, I'm not 100% sure, because as the way of surgeons are, he came in the next morning for all of about 30 seconds and checked a couple of things, and then he was gone. So, and I haven't heard from him since. So, that probably cost me a bomb as well for him to come into my room the next morning. But I basically, I'll see him in the next 2 weeks, and really, it's no bending, no twisting, no lifting, no nothing for a couple of weeks. But had to be done, and we get it done, and we move on. But the one good thing about it is, There's a couple of days of sympathy maybe in my house. So to be able to lie in bed and just watch sport all weekend suited me quite fine.
That's a great result. You did send a very, very disturbing photograph, an image.
I had to delete it.
Yeah, an image of what was taken from your back. Rammer, I was having dinner at the time, or about to have dinner. It was a very unsavory moment from you. You got to rethink these things, man. This is disgusting. What's going on in your back?
There's times when people sort of think you're faking it a little bit. So I had to show you. Look, you know, it's a lot of other men, they'll be out. They'll be sort of out for the count, but I had to show you what was there. And I know you, that sort of interests you, that type of stuff, Daniel. So they took a fair chunk of the disc out. I'm just not sure what's left in there, which I probably want to discuss a little bit with the surgeon at some stage.
Well, my take on the lack of conversation with the surgeons post-operative procedures is, if they're talking little, they're pretty happy with the proceedings. So I wouldn't ask too many questions if I was you, Rama. Right?
No.
If they come to you, that's fine, but I don't think you want to go searching for too much here.
No, I think you're absolutely right. The little you know is sometimes the better in these cases, so you just get on with it.
Yeah. But to answer your question from before, Whitey, because Rama wouldn't have been doing anything, I was out gallivanting. I was gallivanting in Eltham. On Saturday night. Had some caught up with some friends we haven't seen for a long, long time. And there's this new little gin distillery in Eltham, Rama, just tucked in the in the industrial sort of estate there in Eltham, which is a fantastic little venture.
Is that near that KFC?
Where's KFC in Eltham?
In Eltham? No.
Where is it?
I think it's in the industrial sort of estate area.
No, I didn't see it. I didn't see it. Probably wasn't looking for it. Looking for other things on my way to the Gin Palace. Nought. Nought as in the number, or close enough to two. No, it's N-A-U-G-H-T. Nought Distilling Company. It's a very fine little establishment. Nice place. Old school gin sort of bar. It was very nice. It's just nice to do something adult. Well, yeah, the kids, Ramo, just out doing big people things.
I was unsure that you knew the postcode of Eltham anymore. Sort of you're more the Leithy eastern suburbs now, aren't you? Sort of Camberwell and those type of areas. You don't get to Eltham too much anymore, do you?
Well, I've dominated those suburbs for years now. It's time to branch out again, get back to my grassroots and see what's on offer in the burbs, the outer burbs these days. But these things are happening. They're popping up everywhere, these sort of joints.
Did you get a hotel room for the night or what did you do?
No, there's no hotel room for the night, but it was okay. That was just got out there. Didn't go too berserk, but just had a nice couple of beverages, Rama, with adult company, no kids. Oh, magnificent.
I thought you might have been in Chapel Street on sort of Friday night with the impromptu party.
What about that?
That was going off.
I must admit, I did look to see if Joe Pignataro is going to be there. He's that sort of guy. He loves the crowd. He loves to get the arms up and about and wave them around like he just don't care. I was sure that we were going to see Pignataro there. But wasn't that amazing?
Well, they were just enjoying a bit of freedom, I think. And you listened again yesterday to Dan the Man, and we're going to get a little bit more freedom this Friday coming again. So we can start to travel and get back into regional Victoria, which is nice. So, exciting. It's funny when you say exciting times in Victoria, isn't it? Real exciting times.
Exciting times related to do stuff. Yes. It was an interesting weekend. Alas, of course, there is a little cohort out there that's trying to destroy as much of the joy as possible. And we had a little experience at Mabel's, Mabel Jones, 67 Grimshaw Street in Greensboro. Great cafe. Pop in. Make sure you double faxed. Because this whole vaccination conversation is getting, like, poor old small business. It's a debacle. So we've got an email mid-afternoon on whenever it was from someone saying that they were going to contemplate taking us to the Human Rights Commission for a breach of civil human rights by discriminating against the non-vaccinated patrons. What about a way to suck the life out of you? The energy of a reopen after all this time, and you get that. Now, it's a sort of a cut-and-paste template that's going around from some imbeciles. But it sucked the life out of the staff. I'll give you the tip. There's some ordinary people out there. Some ordinary people. $110,000 fine you can cough up if you serve or allow unvaccinated people into your premises.
Is it really?
$110,000. Yeah. Yep, so you're playing by the rules, and then you get that just to suck the life out of you. There's some very, very ordinary humans out there.
That's the thing. All you're doing is playing by the rules and trying to serve people and bring a bit of joy back into people's lives, I suppose.
Yeah, and run a business. But, it's a nothing sort of threat, but it did put them on their heels, the staff, which was disappointing. But that can happen, but that's all right. That's all right. We'll move forward in a couple of weeks' time. Well, they're talking 80,000 at the G, Whitey, for Boxing Day.
Well, I think that was the thing that surprised a few people yesterday was that not only have they sort of brought forward reopening at 80% a couple of extra days, but they're talking about what happens at 90% vaccination. And the thought is that will be around about the 24th of November, and then it's pretty much all bets off from that point. And we can start talking about 80%. Oh, sorry, not 80%, 80,000 at Boxing Day for the test match, and away we go sort of thing. So it was a pleasant surprise to have that happen yesterday. So, yeah.
I imagine that's a positive sign for the Australian Open as well.
Well, I mean, I think the thing with the Australian Open is it's all still about whether you can get into the country and not be vaccinated. And so that's the problem for, yes, there'll be an Australian Open, but what it looks like with how many players will actually be there. Because as it stands at the moment, I think this is really interesting, is the top four men's players in the world have not publicly declared whether they are vaccinated or not. The top four.
So who are they?
Now you're really testing me. Djokovic, Medvedev, Tsitsipas, and Zverev. I think they're the four. Of all, they haven't said they aren't, but they haven't said they are. Now, as it stands at the moment, they're not getting into Australia unless they are. So they'll have to declare their hand at some point, but as it stands at the moment, they're not.
Right.
That's their right not to declare it, though. It's...
No, it absolutely is. But if they arrive at Melbourne Park in early January or late December, we know that they are.
Correct.
So, but, I mean, as I said, it's interesting. It's interesting because it does look like Australia, and this is the whole thing, and again, we don't want to sort of get down this path again, but Australia's going to be one of the most vaccinated countries in the world. So as a result of that, that's going to give us, you know, a hell of a lot more freedom than potentially some other countries. Or are we going to have more success at getting on with life?
Well, yeah,
as a result of the vaccination.
Not so much more freedom, because other countries are quite free. They're just... Like, you look at the States, we've obviously referenced them a fair bit, Ramon, in the last couple of months with all those college football crowds and sporting crowds we've seen just heaving at these big stadiums.
Well, the last six weeks, half, all we've been watching in the States between the college football, the NFL, the basketball, the baseball is just crowds. You know, no masks, essentially just getting on with life and not worrying about things. But we're going to have enough test events prior to the Boxing Day test, prior to potentially 80,000 people being there, to see how this all works with the vaccination passports, how you get in and out of grounds and the like, so the general public is protected as much as possible.
Speaking of big events in the US, the NBA is one of those, and it's kicked off recently, Remo, last Wednesday. I think it might have been for the kickoff for this season. What have you made of the LA Lakers situation? What's going on there? They're zipping two. They've been beaten by the Warriors and the 76ers in their first two games. And there's been fracas on the bench with some of the biggest names. Remember, what's going on at the LeBron James-led LA Lakers?
Yeah, well they're 0-2, so it's not panic stations yet, but they're not playing with any continuity within their lineup. So Anthony Davis and Dwight Howard had a bit of a fracas on the bench during a timeout over the weekend. So definitely not all well there, but let's give it another, I think another, you know, they need at least another 15 or so games to work it out. They're a bit of an older lineup. So it's going to take time to gel and see how it goes. But it was always the question mark of having all these star players, all these star older players, how it would eventually work for them. And so far it hasn't. They lost all their preseason games. They've lost their opening two games. So it's a watch. It's an interesting watch over, I think, over the next, you know, particularly to Christmas.
I'm intrigued by that, I must admit.
Can we talk just quickly? We spoke 80,000 people, Whitey, to the cricket. Was last night's cricket game between India and Pakistan the most watched sporting event ever? Do we know any official numbers on that game yet? Because they were talking the viewing audience would be in the billions.
I don't know whether they have that information yet, but it would go close because obviously India and Pakistan, talk about traditional rivals. They certainly fall into that bracket of traditional rivals. But they may have turned off pretty early because it was a non-event.
There were some really good signs from Davey Warner yesterday. I think he pulled Rabada for four. He played a beautiful cover drive. He played a great cut shot. Finch's captaincy was brilliant yesterday. And he's another one that he had knee surgery. It might take a little bit of time for him to get moving. He's working hard in the nets in his preparation. I don't think it's so much of a mental thing for Finchie. I think it's just getting back into some rhythm, getting used to his leg feeling good again.
Welcome back to The Breakfast Club. That is the voice of Justin Langer. He is the coach of the Australian cricket team, and he was talking about the form of David Warner and Aaron Finch. He's got their backs, Whitey. He's got their backs.
Yeah, but it still is a concern because you largely win T20 matches when your top three or four is firing. And at the moment, Australia's top three isn't. And, you know, I don't know how long they'll carry them. They'll probably, you know, they'll, Finch will play the entire tournament because he is, I still think he's probably the best captain in T20 cricket with the way he goes about it. And he did it again. The way that he worked his bowlers and the plans that they set for the South Africans was very, very impressive. But if they're to progress, you know, into the last four or into the last two, they've got to find a way to get those guys playing better because they're not playing well enough. So they limped over the line against South Africa. They didn't get, they made it far too dramatic to what they needed it to be.
They chased them 120.
Yeah, and they waited till the last over before they got there. And they needed 8 runs off the last over to win. So they've got to be better than that against South Africa, who aren't a particularly good team. Yes, they won, but when you see what some of the other teams are doing at the moment, I still think they've got their miles off it.
So for those playing at home, Warner made 14 off 15. Finch was 0 off 5. And Mitch Marsh, 11 off 17. That's your top three for the Australian batting order the other night against South Africa. Steve Smith, 35. Glenn Maxwell, 18. And my man, the Stoin, Marcus Stoinis, and Matthew Wade guiding us to victory, 24 and 15, respectively, off 16 and 10. But as you say, left it way too late. We got way too tight for a game that should have been over 14, 15 overs.
Yeah. And the thing that Langer said after the game was, well, expect to see lower scores in the World Cup matches that because of the pitches, you know, there might be it's 130 you've got to get or 125, you know, that sort of thing. I don't see it being that way at all. And based on what we've seen overnight and even in the way England have started their tournament, you need more than that. You're needing 150, 160 to be competitive at least, I reckon, against the good teams.
The reality is, Whitey, you always had the question mark on our batters, on our batting lineup. Now, if you look at our bowlers, as you said, they've all bowled well. Hazelwood's in ripping nick at the moment. He's played the most cricket. But is that the correct batting lineup that we have right now? Is that our best batting line? Is that our best combination of a batting lineup?
I don't think it is, but it's what they'll go with because that's what they go with. You know, I don't mean to be smart by saying that, but I don't see them changing it now because they used those matches against the West Indies and Bangladesh to fiddle around with a few things. That's what they want to go with. You know, I still think Josh Inglis should be in that team. But then again, you know, Matthew Wade did what he had to do in that first game also. So you can only do what you can do when you get the opportunity. So to me, probably one of the more interesting things was the bowling lineup they went with. They went with that really experienced fast bowling cartel of Cummins, Hazelwood, and Stark. And Hazelwood was outstanding, but they went with the three.
Cummins was good too, wasn't he?
He was okay. But they went with the three gun fast bowlers, their test bowlers, to get themselves a win. They dropped Kane Richardson. They didn't play Agar. It was an interesting way that they went about it. But really, it was Glenn Maxwell that got them going to start with. They were able to get four overs out of him. Stoinis didn't have to bowl, and they, you know, they did what they had to do to win. So they won, unlike one of the more fancy teams overnight, Daniel.
Well, you were talking about India there because they took on Pakistan in the billion-person event, or maybe multiple billion-person event last night in the World Cup. Who knows how many watched it. I can tell you that India batted first, Whitey, for those playing at home, and they made 7 for 151 in their 20 overs allocated. Virat Kohli made 57 off 49, top scorer. And Rishabh Pant, 39 off 30, a riding shotgun with him. So 7 for 151. And Pakistan, in reply, just snuck home in the end. None for 152.
Amazing.
In the 18th over. It was a clinic by Mohammad Rizwan and Babar Azam, who scored 79 and 68 respectively.
Yeah, so they've done that so well against the tournament favourites. They might not be tournament favourites after that result. But, yeah, as you said before, Rizwan, 79 off 55, 3 sixes and 6 fours. Babar Azam, who's one of the most classy players in the world, 68 off 52 with 2 sixes and 6 fours. And, yeah, they've done it with 13 balls to spare. I mean, 151's okay to good. But Pakistan, against that bowling attack, it's a very impressive effort.
So the scores are interesting across the weekend. And obviously, opposition plays a part in this, Rami, as we all know. What you're up against. South Africa made 118 against us. We snuck home with 121. West Indies decided that they'd start the season with a little bit of a Wow, they're still in Calypso holiday mode. And they were going to take the odds on offer at tab.com.au if they just tanked this first game. So 55 for them all out in 14. 55 all out in 14.2 overs. England had no issues there. So we'll give England a bit of a pass here in terms of the scoring. Bangladesh made 171 last night against Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka topped them in the 19th over, 172. And India-Pakistan, 151 and 152 respectively. So Justin was talking about lower scores in a World Cup. We're seeing relatively, from the start, relatively meek scores so far.
They're moderate.
150 is not a bad score. 170 is a good one last night, Bangladesh and Sri Lanka.
Yeah, I think you want 150 minimum.
Well, I'm saying you want to go to 180 probably really to be pushing the best team. So, you know, Sri Lanka do it easy at 172. Pakistan, as you said, they do it easy at 152. So you want to be starting to push the 180.
It also depends where you're playing as well. Abu Dhabi has a little bit more pace in the wicket than Dubai and Sharjah. So that suited, you know, the Cummins, Stark and Hazelwood combination. So, look, we'll see. We'll see. Interesting. It's interesting because Australia are clearly going in with some issues with their batting. Now, you don't really want that in a T20 World Cup. But their bowling is probably more suited to conditions outside of the Middle East. But, you know, they're thereabouts.
Well, I'm telling
you.
I'll
tell you what. One of those teams over the weekend could have used Sophie Devine. That's who they could have used.
Soph was going big yesterday for the Scorchers.
That was enormous yesterday. I was just sort of just watching that, just lying on my back and, you know, looking for something to watch. And that was very entertaining. Very, very entertaining yesterday.
The Scorchers keep getting this season off very nicely from her perspective. 101 off 60 for Soph in their victory over the Sydney Thunder, who are very
just
young.
Lazy eight sixes.
Just the lazy eight big ones. It's not a bad performance, Rama. Eight big ones.
That's unbelievable. It was so entertaining watching that. Perth put up 186, which is an unbelievable score, but 100 of those runs come from Sophie. It was an amazing innings. Amazing just watching that.
It was a fair partnership from she and Beth Mooney at the top of the order. My girl Beth, who helped her out, just guided her out, just played her role. Ramage got a 50-odd for Beth. Just getting the job done and let the big hitter go berserk. Yesterday, it was a good weekend of WBBL action, actually. It was nice. Nice to watch
that.
They
lost the whole day. They lost the Saturday with rain, but yesterday was quite good.
Someone's picked this up off the SMS too. Have you seen the big tower at the Grand Prix? Where people are spectating from the top of. It's hilarious. It's like this big carnival ride where you sit at the top in this chair and watch it all unfold. It'd be an unbelievable vantage point.
Would you describe it as a carnival atmosphere?
Well, it doesn't move, so I imagine.
Yeah, but it's a whole carnival. It does move. It's a whole carnival. It's like down the Rye Carnival.
It's been stationary at the top. It's at 12 o'clock. It's been
I think it stays there then for a bit, and then it swings around.
Well, I imagine you've got to get down at some stage.
Here's a small little idea. So the Melbourne Star, that's no longer.
Well, I think it might have a sort of a late sort of save potentially.
But what about putting the Melbourne Star in the middle of Albert Park Lake? Because Albert Park Lake is reasonably shallow, isn't it?
Well, so you just walk through the lake to get to the wheel.
Yeah, pontoon.
No, they could put a little board. I could put a boardwalk there. Yeah, but imagine the wheel then, and then you can sell those little pod things that they are, and you can watch the Grand Prix. It could spin around just slowly throughout the day. You know, have drinks in there. It could be like a super box half. Perfect.
Well, for the Grand Prix, it's a terrific idea, except, of course, if the bottom of the wheel goes underwater.
A water wheel.
I don't think that's going to happen. Come on.
No, I quite like the concept. It's an expensive investment for two days a year. But if you can find another way,
it's not a bad spot to have it, too, because then, you got nice little views of Port Phillip Bay there, I imagine, back into the city.
Just put it on the back of the truck, take it down, take it back.
Well, hey, what's it doing where it is now in Docklands? That is the worst spot for it. It's hopeless there.
Oh, I don't disagree with that. Well, clearly that's what's happened because the business has gone bust. That business hasn't worked. So that's pretty straightforward. pretty straightforward. Hey, we saw the Wallabies, spoke about Michael Liner there, former Wallabies captain. The Wallabies were in action as part of their spring tour against Japan, 32-23 across the weekend. So they continue their good recent run.
Five in a row,
Rammer, spot on. And now they're going to need to be better if they're going to take on the Mites when they get a little bit further into their tour. But it's momentum. We've talked about this a bit in the last couple of months. That just all of a sudden you start to limp, you win, and winning becomes a habit, Rami. You know this better than anyone. Winning's a habit. Yeah. And it was something was a bad habit for the Wallabies for a while.
Just belief in what you're doing, I think, is more important. The Wallabies, they've been ordinary over the past. So now five in a row, albeit it was against Japan and they probably should have won by more. They let Japan back into that game late. But winning form's good form. They need to continue that on. The confidence within the group now. Dave Rennie's doing a really good job with them. So who knows? You know, who knows? They're a young team. They've got some, as we said half a couple of weeks ago, there's a lot of guys that you've never heard of. You simply never heard of who they are, what they do. But you start to watch, I think you see what they're trying to do with this team. They're trying to create a team that's going to be together for a number of years that they can take to potentially multiple World Cups.
Yeah, we spoke to John Eales a couple of weeks ago, Whitey, didn't we? And he was a bit bullish about the prospects.
Yeah,
for the first time on the Wallabies.
Absolutely. He could tell. He it was genuine. He thought, no, they're on the right track here. So, but, I mean, as you say, though, that they are playing teams that you would expect them to beat. They've found a little soft part of their world draw, haven't they?
Well, yes. You can only bet what you're up against. So they did their bit. In other rugby news across the weekend, the mighty All Blacks decided that they weren't happy with their loss against South Africa a couple of weeks ago. So they went and played USA. USA. Yep. And just put on 104 against the United States. Just put on 104 to 14. They did cough up 14, so that's a setback.
Did you see the footage of the New Zealanders doing the haka?
Yes.
And then the Americans just having a little giggle when they were doing the haka. So, they took that personally, I think.
Well, I don't know if it was. I'm in the other camp on this one, Ram. I thought the US guys were just enjoying the show, as opposed to mocking or taking the mickey out of them. I thought they would sit there going, "This is pretty cool."
No, I think the American arrogance was, "What are these guys doing?"
Oh, well, you know my view on the haka.
You'd love it. You're into that.
No, they shouldn't do it.
Song and dance theatre stuff. You love it.
They shouldn't do it.
Why is that?
Why should they?
Well, why shouldn't they?
Because
traditional.
What do the other team do? They don't do a dance whatever.
Yeah, but they don't have something that's traditional to them. If they did, I'm sure they'll be more than happy for them to do it. No. I think it's fantastic for sport. Love it. Absolutely love it.
No. Just play the game.
Just so dismissive.
Just play the game. Sing the national anthem and play the song. Get on with it.
So should Liverpool not sing Never Walk Alone before their games?
That's completely different.
Why
set
is that
of circumstances.
Different?
Because it's a club. It's a club thing, and it's the song that they sing as they come out onto the ground.
I don't know.
That's a crowd related thing.
Same.
No.
So is the haka. That's a country related thing.
Yeah.
No.
I think you've made a little bet there.
No, I haven't actually.
You have,
because you've got the national anthems for each team. Play the game. Now, not some sort of choreographed thing. Well, I don't care how traditional it is. You do that in your own time. You're there, play rugby.
Well, no, I think you made a bet there.
Nah.
We'll get to Liverpool in just a second. But Tony in Geelong wants to jump on the line and have a chat to you boys. Tony, good morning.
Morning, Daniel. Now, I'm a bit confused about racing. Now, I've watched the Cox fight, and I don't understand how when the jockey of the winner says, "I didn't celebrate when I passed the line because I bumped the other horse," and the steward's report says that he brushed him, you watch the race from every different angle. There's a rule of racing that says you must maintain a straight line, and if you don't, you've got to stop riding. Steward's report says he was told he must stop riding earlier than he did because he was changing course. The margin was nothing. Now, you boys, Adam and Adam Rammer, that is, and you, Daniel, when you play football and you are going towards the ball and you had an opponent trying to push you out of the way and you're running side by side, is that an inconvenience?
Well, not with my powerful glutes, but it was for the people that I used to do it to, Tony. I get your point.
Right. So Craig Williams can't ride his horse for three strides because the other horse has shifted ground and has taken him clearly two horses off his line. And when they've passed the post, a half a stride past the post, Animo is clearly in front. So how they can come up with, oh, we can't conclusively say that that's cost him the race. So I'm going to throw this at you. If you can't conclusively say that's cost him the race, why couldn't they go, we can't conclusively say that, but we think that the margin was affected, so therefore we will declare a dead heat.
I don't know if there's a provision for dead heat results in appeals if you're doing that sort of stuff. Someone with more race knowledge than us, certainly me, will be able to help you out with that through the morning. But just on the situation, Robert Cram, the chief steward, was on Correct Weight yesterday on RSN 927, and he said this on that situation.
And it's clear from the evidence and the video coverage that State Arrest did shift in and brush Animo and did take him in off his line at that stage. And that occurred passing the 100 metres. Then they had free racing, unimpeded racing, from about the 80 metres to the finishing line.
So seemingly from Robert Cram and the steward's perspective, that whilst there was an element of contact, as he said, he brushed him, as you said, Tone, the fact that there was a chance to continue momentum through 80 metres might have been one of the major contributing factors for the outcome from the stewards on Saturday. I must admit, I was a bit like you. I thought that Animo would get the race.
If it wasn't a Cox plate, would have you got the race?
Well, you'd like
was
to...
It, say it was the McKinnon or say it was the... Maccabi Diva Stakes, would have been handled differently, do you think?
Well, according to the stewards, it's the same if it's a maiden at Avoca.
Yeah, you would hope not.
I understand that, but do you think it would have been different?
Well, you can only go on the integrity of the stewards saying that this doesn't matter the race. It was the result they got. They got the result saying the winner was the winner. So, I don't know. Who knows? Who knows what if it would have been benchmark 64 at Mornington on a Monday. Would have been a different result. We don't know.
Yeah, because my inclination watching it was that I reckon they might overturn this, but they won't because it's the Cox plate.
The tricky part
Raymond, the reason I mean that is that to me it would have to be absolutely compelling to change the result of a Cox plate. So it's line ball, you end up erring on the side of status quo rather than turning it over.
Animo sort of came up from behind where State Arrest was. You just wonder if Johnny Allen saw where Animo was, because Johnny Allen just wanted the best ground.
He did stop right. He did straighten the horse when he started to wander. He did straighten the horse, so he knew that State Arrest was on the fly, was coming in towards the other horse. So he knew that.
Running through them, State of Rest has got the split. 300 to go, and the Irish horse sprints clear. State of Rest a length. Animo follows it through, and Very Elegant to the outside at the 200. State of Rest a neck. Animo, Very Elegant late. It's State of Rest at the 100. Animo wearing it down. State of Rest just in front of Animo. State of Rest holding on. State of Rest, I think, has just won for the Emerald Isle from Animo and Very Elegant.
That's how the race was called by the magnificent Matthew Hill on Saturday for the Ladbrokes Cox Plate, the 101st edition of, and it was a State of Rest who got the chocolates past the post. It took a little bit of a steward's inquiry to confirm the result, but it was a Cox Plate victory for Joseph O'Brien, who knows what he's doing when he brings horses to Australia. His record is nothing but remarkable. He's been good enough to join us this morning on The Breakfast Club. Hello, Joseph. Congratulations.
Morning, guys. Thank you very much.
Great to have you with us. What time was it for you when you were watching the race on Saturday or Friday night, wherever it was?
It wasn't too bad. It was just after 7 a.m. In the morning. So we were in the office and watching on. And, it was a fantastic morning.
Well, I'm sure it was when you end up as the winner. What did you think in the last 100 metres, 150 metres, when it was in real time? Did you think that, we might need to see the front-on footage here?
No, I actually didn't realise that, you know, I watched it obviously live and I didn't think there was anything to worry about until the stewards was called and they showed the, I think it was the rear view camera, and I thought it was a little bit of interference then. So, you know, in Europe, I would have been pretty confident that there wouldn't have been any change. But just, you know, I'm not as familiar with your stewards there. So, it was a bit nervous, Harry.
Oh, I'm sure it was. And it took a long time, too, to get the result. And the longer it went, the more nervous I got for you, I must admit, even though I wasn't invested financially or emotionally like you would have been. So to get a Cox plate, I mean, you've won two Melbourne Cups in 2017 and 2020 with Twyla Payman and Rekindling. We'll talk more about Rekindling soon. Two Melbourne Cups, and now you've got a Cox plate. Where does that sit in sort of your markers for your training career and what you wanted to achieve when you first got the reins?
Yeah, it's very, very special. You know, even to be able to compete in those races is very special. Very lucky that I have a great bunch of owners at home who support me and the team that we have, and owners who are game to give races like this a go. And obviously, you know, Lloyd and Nick Williams have been very good to me since I started training, and you know, they really opened my eyes to racing in Australia.
So, Joseph, tell us what happens when the protest siren goes off. Are you then on the phone instantly? Do you get into the stewards' room? You know, with modern technology now, how do you go about? Did you have any influence on the hearing? What did you do during the protest?
Well, I suppose I spoke to my travelling foreman, Mark Power, immediately, and he represented me in the stewards' room. And obviously, John Allen, who rode the horse, was in there as well. And really, you know, it was up to them. I believe they gave their evidence and the stewards listened to everyone. And then they deliberated for quite some time.
So you said before, Joseph, that you were originally thinking that would be okay. But then when you saw that behind angle, how nervous did you get? Were you still relatively confident, or was that a really stressful time for you?
No, I was pretty confident, but just... it was more the fact that I don't know how the stewards, obviously I'm not as experienced with dealing with inquiries and how the stewards look at incidents like that in Australia. Had it been in Europe or in you know, any jurisdiction that we're used to racing in, I would have been very confident that the result wouldn't have been swapped. But just I wasn't sure how the stewards down there would take to it. And obviously when the inquiry went on for so long, it was a little bit more nerve-wracking. But, you know, I was pretty hopeful that we would get the result, but just when it was going on for so long, we did get a bit nervous. All right.
Yeah, certainly went a long time. Tell us about State of Rest. When did you think that you had a horse that was capable of winning the Cox Plate?
I suppose it wasn't until after his win in Saratoga, before the race, the Cox Plate, that it really came into his radar. He had an option in the Breeders' Cup also, and he had a group one in the UK. So, you know, the prize money was fantastic, and we thought the 10 furlongs there would suit him well. So that was really, we discussed it with the owners and Richard Ryan and Jim Coburn, and they were keen to give it a go.
So we've got a race that stops the nation in the Melbourne Cup. You've won it twice. And then we've got the Wait for Age Championship of the World in the Cox Plate, which you won on Saturday. Do you have a favourite? Is there one that sort of sticks out that you think is better to win or bigger to win?
No, I don't think so. I think, obviously, the Melbourne Cup is an incredibly special race, and obviously the history, and, you know, it is the race that stops the nation. So that's a very special race. But I suppose insofar as making a stallion or commercially, the Cox Plate is a very, very big race, and, you know, State of Rest is a high-class stallion prospect now, you know, on both hemispheres, really, at this stage of his career, and, you know, the Cox Plate that made him that.
So trainers go through their whole career here in Australia and never even get close to a Melbourne Cup or a Cox Plate, not even in their wildest dreams. You're so young still. You've been able to do it from the other side of the world. How do you do it?
Like I said earlier, I'm very good, very lucky that we have a great team of owners who support us well. We have a great team of people. Mark Power, obviously, who's travelled down to Australia with the horses the last 2 years. Baz, who's our head man. And Mark Hackett in the office, who managed all the logistics of the travelling over the last number of months. So I have a great team of people, a great team of owners, and you know, we're lucky that we have nice horses too.
Did Did you identify any other horses that you thought you might bring to Australia for the Cox Plate, or was this the only one that you thought was suitable?
He was the obvious horse after. You know, he'd won it, like I said, the Group 1 he won last time was a fight last time, the track, 9.5 furlongs. So, we were pretty confident that he would handle the race and, really what you need for to go around the valley.
Well, he handled it pretty well, and in the end was the winner, State of Rest, which was magnificent. Back-to-back Group 1s from Saratoga to the Valley. Not too many horses have done that. In fact, probably none in Australian racing. What about Twilight Payment, the reigning Cups champ from last year? He's out of quarantine now at the Werribee International Horse Centre. He's been here. He's done that. What's the team saying on the ground here about his condition and his preparedness to go back-to-back in the Melbourne Cup?
Yeah, we've been pleased with how he travelled, pleased with how he's trained down there. So it's a big ask to go back with 58 kilos. But listen, he's in good shape and we'll give it our best shot.
The challenge, the 58 kilos is a big impost, and you know that better than anyone. But it, being a more seasoned horse, is he capable of carrying that to put up as good a showing as he did last year, do you think?
We hope so, but I think it's going to be a big ask. But he's trained really well, and if you're not in, you can't win. So we're going to give it our best shot.
Now, Joseph, I've got two more questions for you. Firstly, on Johnny Allen, it was such a big day for him. He's going to be joining the guys on Racing Pulse, our racing show, a little bit later on this morning. How special was it for you to have a fellow Irishman on board?
Very special. And Johnny actually started off in Ireland working for my granddad at the farm that I trained from. So the connection goes back a number of years, and really, it was very special to have him on board, and he's obviously a top rider, and we were very lucky to be able to get him, to be able to secure him for the race.
Now, you learnt so much from your dad, one of the world's most famous trainers. Is he now ringing you asking for advice with the sort of success you're having?
No, absolutely not. But we speak every day, and I'm very lucky that I grew up in the position that I did, and everything I learned from, mum and dad. And, that phone call is only one way at the
bill. But more importantly, Joseph, now is the seat at the main table. You sort of getting right towards the head of the table now, or you're still in the middle of the table?
I'm getting shoved down to the bottom.
She wants to go again and finish the game, and that is even better. Brilliant hitting from Harmon Preet-Gore. That's the way to finish off the game.
I agree, Richo. It was a magnificent way to finish off the game yesterday. Two big sixes by Harmon Preet-Gore, the Indian captain who is representing the Melbourne Renegades in the WBBL, and that finished the game against the Sydney Sixers. A comprehensive victory it was by the girls in red, and that's good for me because I barrack for them. And Simon Helmut, it's good for him too. He's the coach of the Renegades in the Women's Big Bash this season, and he's doing a hell of a job. Helmo, good morning.
Good morning, gents. How are you?
We're going well. Not as well as you, though. That was impressive yesterday. The plans in place, Simon, they were very, very good. Did you sit back upon reflection last night and go, you know what, guys? I think we nailed it today.
I think we did. I think Sophie did an awesome job, and the leaders out on the ground are just up and out there. They read the conditions pretty well. That wicket had been under covers for near on 2 days. A lot of rain up here in Lonnie. So, yeah, it was really good. Really pleased the way the girls played, and to finish it off in style like that with Harmon Preet-Gore, who's become a really important member of our squad after, three or four matches.
So, coming into this game, I mean, it's only been a couple of games to start the campaign so far. Have you been happy with what's come together, the way it's coming together before the game yesterday?
It was going beautifully until Georgia Wareham did a knee.
Yeah, well, there you go, yeah.
And then that was a disaster. She took 3 for 11 and off 4 overs in her first match. Her and Sophie Molyneux did really well in that first game. Had a bit of a hiccup in the second game against the Strikers, who I think are a very good, solid team. Happy. As you know, in tournaments like this, when there's 14 matches, you sort of want to work your way into the tournament. You want to play all your good stuff at the start.
Yep.
But I think we're doing enough good things at the moment with bat, ball and field. But there's still a few little areas of improvement, maybe some of the stuff with the batting, just a few less dot balls, a few bigger partnerships, just in case you have to chase down those bigger scores when the wickets get drier and flatter later on in the summer.
So, Simon, when you're playing against a team like the Sixers, do you play against the individual or do you play against the team? Because they've got so many dangerous players. Is the plan to go on your strengths or go against that particular individual because they can be so dangerous and take the game away from you quickly?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a combination of both, Rama. I reckon for us yesterday, we had specific plans to bowl to individuals to try and make as uncomfortable as possible. Look, and that, sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. But look, for us, it was there was a general theme and a general plan on where we wanted to try and get the sixes to hit the ball. It was a good wicket. And so usually in that case, you don't want teams to hit easily square. So the stumps are your friend. Try and stick at the round of the stumps, take the pace off because they have some strong hitters in Healy and Gardner, and then and hopefully, you know, just field as strongly and put the fielders in the best spots to make sure that if you do err, that you've got some protection. And the girls did really well with that yesterday. Doesn't always work. I was interested. I watched the game afterwards and saw Sophie Devine belt 100 off 60 balls. Fortunately, we didn't play against them the day before. The rain stopped the game.
So where are you guys at the moment? Are you feeling more comfortable batting first or bowling first?
Oh, when you're unsure of wickets or conditions, it's always nice to be able to bowl first. So we've won a couple of handy tosses there. Bowl first, find out what the surface is doing, and then you can, you know, bat accordingly. We've been fortunate. The two totals we've chased down have been 100, 120 and 125. So probably the next challenge for us, going back to your previous question, the challenge for us now is just how to work a plan and strategy out with the bat to, you know, give us a chance to make, you know, those 140 plus scores.
It was a pretty handy start when you've got them 3 for 12 and you've got Healy, Verma and Gardner back in the pavilion in four overs. That's almost like the dream start.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Whitey. They give you a headache, those players, especially Healy. You know, she can take a match away from you at any time. The spin worked for us yesterday. We're fortunate we've got some spin depth. We've got some off-pace bowlers. For us yesterday, we only used one over of our proper pace. Ellie Falconer bowled the last over. And it was a shame for Phil, and she missed out altogether, but she fielded really well. So, look, we're just going to have to work the bowling group as best we possibly can, especially with Georgia being out for the rest of the series. And hopefully that'll work for us. But we have one more game here, and then we head off to Perth. So that'll be a different surface and a different opposition.
We've spoken to a few of your players over the last couple of weeks, and they've all commented on the influence of the overseas players, particularly the two Indian stars that you've got in your team. What sort of impact do you think they're having from a coaching perspective?
Harmanpreet, she's the captain of India T20 side, very calm, very organised and experienced. And as you know, we've all talked about this before, T20 is an experienced person's game because you need to problem solve, work through situations. And she did it again yesterday. Jemima Rodrigues, she's a pocket rocket, lots of personality. She's really aggressive top order batsman. I think she was the top run scorer in the 100 recently. So she comes in with good form, and I think she's going to be a very, very, very good player for India in the future. And then Eve Jones has been a really good domestic player, played for the Phoenix last season, and she got a chance opening the batting yesterday, and she nailed it. She got us off to a flyer. So it's really important to get good overseas, not only as cricketers, but also as people, and that fits into our Renegades family really well.
So you bowled spin the first six overs of the power play and took the pace off, as you said, and tried to make it difficult. You got the wickets to capitalise. But then you changed the batting lineup too. Is that something we'll see consistently, different combinations and different and the ways you attack different games depending on surface and team, or particularly from a batting perspective, Helmo, will you try and keep the lineup as stable as possible?
Yeah, try and keep it as stable. But Soph and I had a chat what we could maybe do a little bit differently for this game. And she was very selfless. She's been opening the batting for a while for the Renegades. But we thought, look, that's Eve Jones. She opens the batting for her team over in England. And that's probably where she feels more comfortable. So we felt it was a good opportunity for her to get out there and play her usual role. I'd love to see Jess Duffin get into the game more at some stage half. So yep. We'll probably have to try and orchestrate that. I'm not sure if you saw the game. But
I did.
Second ball, she stepped inside and... she's a really talented player, isn't she? I mean, she obviously has made lots of runs for a long time. And I think if we can try and get her into the tournament a bit more as well, that might be advantageous for us.
You give me that time and space, I'll make things happen too, just like Nick Maddison does with the willow in his hand for the Victorian cricket team. And they get to kick off their Shield season on Wednesday in Sydney, I'm sure. He's very excited about that. He joins us. Good morning, Nick.
Yeah, good morning.
Great to have you with us. It's been a while coming, this, Nick. How excited are you?
Yeah, pretty pumped. Obviously, finished the race since then has been even longer again. So, been ready and up and firing and ready to play since probably end of August, early September. So, it's nice to finally have a game in the calendar and something to look forward to.
We spoke to the coach, Chris Rogers, last week. But from a player's perspective, is it difficult to stop, start, and not really know when that first ball in anger or the first whack in anger is going to actually take place because the timeline kept moving?
To some degree. I think it was just trying to keep guys mentally fresh. And like I said, we kind of start training in June, July. So by the time September rolls around and you're expecting to play, everyone's up and ready to go. So it's probably just a bit of a maintenance thing and making sure you're not in there too much to get stale and make the season feel even longer than it is. But I think, like I said, everyone's been up and going for a while and we're pretty happy to be in Sydney and looking forward to the game on Wednesday.
And how are you seeing them at the moment?
I'm seeing them okay. I haven't been hitting them that well, to be honest. Missed out in the last couple of practice games I've had down in Victoria before coming up. But, yeah, obviously, once you get into some match competition, everything like that, you're just getting the moment and you battle away. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to the game and spending some time in the middle, hopefully.
I want to ask you about that, Nick. I mean, you've played against each other now for such a long period of time, even three-day practice matches. And has it been hard to get the intensity required for you to get the best out of yourself in that sort of scenario?
I think as a squad, like the intensity's been there, and it's probably a credit to everyone that's been playing these practice games because they can kind of linger on a little bit, especially when you do play, I think, maybe six of them like we have. So the intensity's been there and the competition's been there every time I've played, which is great. But personally, yeah, I'm keen for a bit of match competition. Been playing for nearly 12 years now, so the practice games, they wear thin pretty quick, to be honest. But, yeah, looking forward to a bit of match competition and having the competitiveness of a Shield game.
Yeah, because I noticed that yourself, and even to a lesser extent, but a bit the same, Marcus, didn't do as well as some of the younger players. But I guess that's the benefit, to see some of the younger players, less experienced players, get some big runs ahead of the series, because I think if Victoria are to be competitive, it might be up to the younger guys to come through and help the senior players, of which you're one of.
Yeah, of course. It's been great seeing some of the guys score runs. It's been Mackenzie Harvey, Jake Fraser-McGurk, both scored hundreds in the last couple of games. So they've had a taste of cricket for Victoria in the last few seasons and a bit of Shield cricket last year for Jake. So like I said, it's pretty important for a squad to have everyone contributing, and there's definitely going to be times throughout the season where we lose people for Australian selection or injuries come into it, and guys like that will get an opportunity to put their best foot forward. And as we saw with sort of Mitch Perry last year from a bowling point of view, and Will Sutherland as well, they're contributing and almost some of the first guys picked in the team now. So I think we're in a pretty strong position.
So, Nick, there's light at the end of the tunnel now with competitive games around the corner for you guys. But when there wasn't, do you get sick of it? Do you just go, you know what, I've had enough of this. It's all too hard. I don't want to compete against my teammates anymore. Do you just find the motivation levels were hard to find at times?
I did, personally, yeah, of course. I think we were kind of lucky that once we realised that we weren't playing sort of a few weeks ago when we were penciled in to go to Adelaide, and that kind of got cancelled, that, training eased back a little bit. We had kind of a week off where guys were coming in individually to get the work done, and it wasn't as much structure and sort of team sessions. It was on the player to come in and get what they needed, or they could have a week off. And I think little things like that definitely helped. But, yeah, I was, once we got to end of September and kind of looked forward to Adelaide, and then that got pulled out right at the last minute, it was a little bit frustrating. And personally, yeah, I did just check out for a little bit the last couple of weeks to try and stay fresh mentally. But yeah, obviously with the practice games last week, you get back into the swing of things and it doesn't take much to get going and get yourself back up and running.
So what do you use to get yourself out of those sort of situations? Because I imagine you'll face those throughout the rest of your career at certain stages. How do you get yourself up and going?
Yeah, it's probably important in the environment at the moment as well with COVID. We've experienced a little bit of it last year, and that probably taught me a few things. And it's probably about just being able to get away from the game while you're on the road a little bit, and you know, connect with friends and family in different states if you have them there, and take time to put a bit of work in yourself. Whether it's, you know, everyone's different. Some guys like to go and play golf. Others have different areas and things that they like to do to get away from it all. And it was just finding what was important for me. And obviously down in Melbourne, it was a bit easier when you have, you know, my partner and dogs and family and stuff around, and you can, you know, go for a walk and go to the beach and head off for a day or a week and stuff like that. But yeah, when you are on the road, it does get a little tricky sometimes. And I guess that's important for us to stay fresh. And like you said, stay mentally on top of things throughout the long season in your career.
Now, you're playing at Drummoyne on Wednesday against New South Wales, but do you wish that all Shield games were played at Karen Rolton Oval, Nick?
Oh, by the looks of it. I've only had the one bat there last year. Got injured my first game ever. Yeah, it's, you know, from a top-order batting point of view, it looks a pretty nice place to play, but you always rather a ground that's going to get you a result as well, and you know, it's not really providing that at the moment. But yeah, obviously, Drummoyne, we're not really sure what we're going to get. It hasn't had cricket on it for quite a while, and it was a pretty decent wicket last time. I think the Australia A game last year and the Shield game the year before that actually was a bowler-friendly kind of game. A couple of low scores, and it was really competitive. So I'm not sure what we'll get this week, but yeah, I guess we'll take that as it comes.
We don't need too many haircuts these days, you and I, Rammer. Danny Stevens does, though. She's got a nice head of hair. She's going gangbusters. She was the youngest ever discus world champion, and after, well, 12 years later, has decided that that's enough. She's thrown that thing around the ring enough, and I'm going to go out and do some other things. And she's been good enough to join us on the Breakfast Club this morning. Danny, good morning.
Good morning.
Great to have you with us. Now, 2009, we go back to straight away when we talk about you because you're awesome. As a world champion, the youngest ever discus world champion, it's such a long time ago. Does it feel like that for you?
Yeah, it feels like a whole other life.
Yeah.
It's been such a long time. There's been so many experiences and trips and teams and world champs and Commonwealth Games and Olympics in between now and then. So, yeah, to think back to that day and see footage from back then, which is kind of popping up now that I decided to announce my retirement. It's really nice to relive those memories and realise just what a good time it was.
And it was such a big couple of years for you up until that point. I mean, you went the World Youth Champion in 2005, World Junior and Champion in 2006, and then 2009, you're the World Champion. So your progression was quite linear for that perspective. And then you know, obviously two-time Commonwealth Games World Champion as well. You've had some amazing results in your career. Did you get what you thought you would out of this career?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like, I heard someone say once that you'll never leave the sport achieving everything that you wanted to do. And there's a few things that were driving me the whole time, you know, to throw 70 metres, and I fell just a little bit short with 69, 64 being my PB. And obviously, what winning, you know, an Olympic gold medal or Olympic medal was one of the main drivers as well. So my best result was fourth at the Rio Olympics. So it took a little bit of time to kind of, you know, process those things that I hadn't achieved some of my life goals. But when I look back at it, I've had some incredible experiences. I've met some amazing people. I've got to follow my passion and travel the world and do what I love. So I feel really privileged and grateful to have been able to do that.
Danny, firstly, congratulations on an amazing career. With athletes, with sports people, they carry a lot of injuries. A footballer has bad knees. A tennis player has a bad elbow. A golfer has a bad back. What does a discus thrower have at the end of her career that's like, whoa, you know, I've known I've thrown a discus for a number of years?
Arthritis. I've been doing this, yeah, for such a long time. I've been playing sports since I've been about 4 years old. I joined Little Athletics when I was four in Tiny Tots. I've been pretty lucky for the majority of my career that haven't had too many injuries. You know, we've had a lot of bone stress and stress fracture type repetitive injuries. I wore a lot of splints towards the ends to protect my wrist because they were just shot from all the med balls and bench pressing and Olympic lifting that I've done. And one of the main ones that I had was, the discs in my spine, in my neck the last few years. So I've had some pretty good ones the last few years, but I can honestly say I walk away just feeling a little bit old and crunchy at 33, but pretty much in one piece. So
will it have any effects on you later in life, Danny, the injuries or the just the wear and tear, or do you think it's something that can heal over time?
Yeah, honestly, it's just a little bit of wear and tear. I think as we get older, or any athlete, you know, just that general maintenance that you've got to take, you know, just take it, keep in mind as you're moving. I still got to do a lot of glute activation, shoulder activation. You know, I'm quite loose jointed anyway. I think that was one of the things that made me excel in the sport that I did. I could reach, I had really good flexibility and I could have a lot of strength through range. So I think just moving forward, I just need to keep on top of those things. Obviously still want to stay really active and go to the gym, maybe not lift such big weights, but you know, I've joined just local comp basketball, so I've been running around trying not to bowl people over. So just having fun, but just keeping those little bits of rehab in mind. If something starts to get a little bit tight or a little bit niggly, I kind of know the process that I have to go through to keep those in check. And if not, my physio is 10 minutes around the corner. So I said to her, I'll still be seeing you probably a fair bit.
That was the best of The Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.